Hello, all you gym rats out there. I've joined your ranks.
Yeah? Why are we having this introduction?
Well, because after 9 days in London,
we have 15 restaurants. You're back at the foot of the cross, huh?
Yes, 15 restaurants, not counting family pub lunch, cousin brunch.
Okay. Well, I got...
breakfast, that doesn't include breakfast. I need to spend a lot of time in the gym.
But I lined up lots of good places, you have to admit that, and we're going to get to those soon enough. But just in case you're wondering...
Yeah, we do something besides
we do other things besides
eat and drink.
and one of the exciting things...
This was fun. Well, London itself is really exciting anyhow, isn't it? Just the energy of the city.
Yeah, but one of the most exciting things that's always going on there is the great art that's in the public museums. And we went to several special exhibitions while we were there, as well as admiring the existing collection of several fine institutions. So let's introduce those to you first.
One of my most favorite museums in London is actually the Tate Modern, which is in that old power station.
Yeah, in the old Bankside power station.
Yeah.
And just as if that wasn't enough, they're in the process of building an extension.
Yeah, an addition, yeah.
An addition, and we're not exactly sure what they're going to put there, but...
Oh, they have a model of it, I saw it.
Yeah, they have a model of it, but I think it may be that they want more conventional gallery space.
They do.
Because the engine house, which is the center of the building and what takes up like 75 or 80% of the space in the building, is what they called the turbine room or the engine room, I forget which it is, which is a huge space not really suited to many art exhibits, although it's capable of accommodating art exhibits that wouldn't go just about anywhere else except in the open air.
And if anybody goes to Tate Modern, make sure you pause and look out the window across to St. Paul's and the Millennium Bridge. I mean, it's a glorious sight.
That's a magnificent view. But what caught our attention, and was one of the best art exhibits I've ever been to, and Anne's been to a lot more than I have, but she said it was a great one.
Yeah, is a Yayoi Kusama.
Yeah, a totally remarkable Japanese artist who's...
Who I remember from when she was, first doing her happenings in the States.
And she has an art career already spanning about 60 years. And the most amazing thing, well, two rather amazing things. First of all, she struggles with some mental health issues and spent the last 30-some years actually living in a hospital. Because she feels comfortable in that environment, I guess.
Yeah.
But absolutely dramatic. It was the room for me. Was the last room before the one with all the lights.
Gorgeous.
I mean, there was an incredible installation with lots and lots of color flashing lights. But a room of the freshest artwork you have ever seen.
Yeah.
Walls covered with one wonderful pattern after another.
Beautiful bright colors.
Yeah, bright colors, just an astounding.
Well, she's so versatile. She's done. Painting, she's done installations, she's done happenings, she's done, she's a thorough artist, and she's associated a lot with polka dots. That may trigger an image of her art to some people. She usually dresses in the same pattern and colors of polka dots when she's in the room.
But that final room of paintings, which are recent paintings, I guess, paintings of the last 10 years, I haven't seen anything as dramatic or as exciting of an artist at that age other than Picasso when he was seemed to get new energy around the age of 75 or 80 years old and produce some very interesting work at the same time. So this is truly remarkable. The exhibit is on for just a few more weeks. So if you go to London...
It's not going anywhere else, is it?
I think it's coming to somewhere in the United States,
but I don't recall.
Well, anyway,
it's a huge exhibit.
Anyway, if you Google Yayu, spell the last name for me, sweetheart.
Y-A-Y-O-I, and the last name is K-U-S-A-M-A.
So you'll be sure to catch up with it where it's going next. Now, the most exciting exhibit for at least the art-viewing public was at the National Portrait Gallery, not usually a home of great art, more associated with what you read in the title of the gallery, portraits, photographs, and that kind of thing, but an absolutely amazing exhibit of Lucian Freud work.
But he was doing portraits.
Yeah, he was doing portraits. Well, there were some other things other than portraits as well.
Yeah.
So a really remarkable exhibit, and one that... I think the only smart thing to do is either book online or go towards the end of the day. Because towards the end of the day, it was crowded, but it wasn't absolutely mobbed. And the National Portrait Gallery is extraordinarily conveniently located. It's just north of Trafalgar Square and right behind the National Gallery, which was another of our stops. Because the National Gallery had a special exhibition comparing the works of the wonderful J.M.W. Turner and an artist from the previous century, Claude Lorrain.
You know what? I thought that exhibit was a big yawn.
Oh,
absolute big yawn.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
But I've never been all that crazy about that kind of landscape thing anyhow.
But the
I only like Turner's late wild things that are almost abstract.
Well, you're fussier than most people because most people seem to actually love it.
Yeah,
and in any event, the collection in the National Gallery is a truly wonderful collection. Across almost any age. I mean, we didn't see nearly all of the exhibits that are there. We've seen many of them before. But I think every time you go, you find a piece of work that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, and that knockout Titian that they've managed to retain.
Well, that's the latest thing is that they managed to retain in the United Kingdom, thanks to a collection from lots and lots of charitable organizations and gifts from the general public. They've managed to rescue the second of a pair of Titian paintings, this one Diana and Callista, going together with a Titian that was already in the National Gallery's collection, also incidentally saved by public subscription just a few years ago. And only one of them, the new one, the newly owned one, the Diana and Callista, is on exhibition right now. If you go later in the year, after September, the two Titians are going to be united.
But they'll be in Scotland.
In the same room. No, it's going to Scotland in 2013.
Okay, well, you got to time it, listeners, because half the time it spends in Scotland, half the time in London.
Now, we're still trying to find out where the other four paintings, which are taken from Ovid's Metamorphoses, are located. So we have to go find those.
Now, where do we see the Picasso?
And then at the Tate Britain.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Probably. No, I think it's my favorite museum only because Tate Modern is so specialized in its exhibitions and the Tate Britain has such a wonderful collection. And they pulled together an exhibition displaying the works created by Picasso either when he was in Britain or looking at Britain or inspiring British artists that I thought was a truly remarkable exhibit and an intersection of work that I hadn't thought of before. There was a room full of Ben Nicholson's and Picasso side by side and other paintings that either were inspired by Picasso or were painted because the artists involved knew Picasso, for example, Picasso and Henry Moore, a connection I'd never thought of before.
Well, you know, I think this will justify the fact that we ate so much, but I think it's time if we take a little break and then get back to the business that we're really to be focused on, where we ate and all the chefs that we interviewed.
And two and three top chefs in this program, so we'll introduce those to you one by one, again, as Anne said, after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we're entering now our food section of this program with what has been for a long time a very favorite of our restaurants called The Square. But this is the first time we actually interviewed this remarkable chef owner, Philip Howard, who is, I think, as I mentioned in the interview, responsible for cultivating most of the talent in the contemporary generation of chefs in London.
And what a remarkable meal we had.
Oh.
and Phil was not...
It's worth Phil, going to the gym every minute.
Phil was not kind to us because in the conversation that we had before we did the interview, we were discussing whether the merits of Pyrenean lamb, which is coming to the end of its season right now. And Phil said, oh, well, lamb's just lamb. And since we were having sweetbreads and sea trout instead...
Yeah, I don't think you can say he's not kind. He was underplaying how much food we were going to eat.
So
irresistible, I might add.
It was all irresistible, and we did credit to all of it. We did not have dessert. Even Peter did not have dessert, but we did have a wonderful meal, and there were still several couples who were still eating lunch with us at 3:30 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon as we were leaving. So it's clearly a place you can linger for a long time if you're in the mood for a tasting menu and in the mood to taste some of the best food in London. And Michelin inspectors, I don't know where you are. I really don't understand. This has been a two-star restaurant for 10 or 15 years, and why it doesn't make the next level, I really have no idea. But anyway, here's Phil Howard from the Square.
Well, no, I call him Philip, but I'm instructed by this wonderful chef that people call him Phil. It's Phil Howard, and he is chef owner of a very famous London restaurant, the Square. And part of, I think, the fame and deserved fame comes from the amount of influence that Phil has had over cooking in Great Britain. Welcome to On the Menu, Phil. When I say that, first let's start with, you are very British, but you were born in South Africa, right?
Yeah, I was born in South Africa, and I lived there until I was about 8, and then the UK. So this is where I've grown up.
And in London.
Always been in London.
And we were talking about, you said you've been cooking for a quarter of a century, which sounds like a long, long time. It's only 25 years.
Well, it's over half my life, and I suppose it feels like a long time because I've been at the Square for, you know, this is our 21st year, so I've been walking into this kitchen for 21 years, and that is a long time.
But I asked also, had you ever considered doing anything else?
No, I was educated right up to university level, finishing off with a degree in microbiology, but I never really knew where that was going. Nature, I loved, I always wanted to be Jacques Cousteau, actually. He was my...
Did you really?
Yeah, as I always fancied.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I thought that would be a great life. I was neither bright enough nor committed enough to really pursue sciences on a major level. And luckily enough, when I was at university, I had to keep myself nourished and fed, and I absolutely knew to my core that I found what I'd been put on the planet to do, so to speak.
Well, you're very lucky.
Very lucky. You know, I've got two kids now, you know, a daughter who's 17, and it's really hard, I think, for people to find in time, before they're committed to some profession that their education has channeled them into, or to get that calling, to make it sound a bit, you know, a bit quaint, was incredibly lucky.
Now, the Square, why is it called the Square?
It's called the Square because our original location was just off St. James's Square in St. James's.
Although the cover of your menu is really a circle.
That's just a beautiful slice of a morel, and it's a wonderful circle too. Yeah.
Now, when we talk about your influences, I always think of the Square as a contemporized French... I mean, you're based in French technique and French cuisine, but you are ingredient-driven, you are seasonal.
Yeah.
Now, is this the sort of influence you've had on, especially on modern British chefs?
A lot of people have jumped on the seasonality provenance bandwagon in recent years. 10 years ago, there were quite a few people talking the talk but not actually walking the walk. We have genuinely always been very, very seasonal. We have become more purist as the years have gone by, certainly in terms of sourcing ingredients, carbon footprint, air miles, where stuff's coming from. And we now don't accept the odd piece of fruit in the depths of winter in the UK when there's none to be had locally or a limited selection.
Well, it is a challenge here, yes.
It is a challenge. But even having said that, we don't bring anything in from far afield. We're in London, so there's nothing immediately local, but the majority of our produce is British. We of course step over and buy bits and pieces from France, from the Mediterranean, but don't really go any further afield than that.
Now, I think that you actually have mentored chefs in a variety of other ways, not just kind of an ingredient seasonality, style of food. There's a certain professionalism you've transmitted that comes across the board with some of your most prominent ex-chefs from here.
I think the Square is quite an unusual kitchen.
It is, isn't it?
Well, I think... I don't think I'm your typical typical chef. I certainly don't run the kitchen in the way that that your typical chef does. As a human being, I am the way that I am.
How is that?
I'm not the most disciplined person in the world.
Okay.
I'm very passionate about my ingredients, very passionate about food. but I personally don't run the kitchen in a very rigid way. I look after people, I look out for people, I like to keep chefs in the kitchen for a long time. And the thing which I think is, well, it's not unique in the square, but we are very focused on, I'm an eater. That's what I enjoy doing. I love eating. I'm an eater. And an awful lot of cooking has become very cerebral, necessarily a good thing, I don't think. So you have to think about your menu. Of course you do. But your stomach should play a far bigger role in menu devising than your brain, I think. And I think that's to keep the focus on flavour and what is this food like to eat, that is hugely important and often gets forgotten by a lot of the young, high-ambitious chefs who want to get involved with all these new techniques. And
shticks, we call it in the United States, shticks.
Yeah.
Like the new Nordic cuisine. I don't want to be down on the new Nordic cuisine, but I was just reading before we came over here that somebody tweeted a photograph of somebody who risked his life getting some kind of an insect attached to some kind of vegetation. I thought, this doesn't seem right.
Well, you know, you've got to have people out there who are pushing the boundaries, because without that we would all be very slow to progress. And I'm somebody who is, you know, the cooking at the square is basically French. Steeped in French technique, rigorously seasonal, ingredient-driven, with the basic mission statement, we're here to cook food that packs a mighty punch in terms of flavor.
And we were here 11 years ago, was it? And this is a very different menu. So you have changed, adapted, progressed.
Yeah, we do quietly progress. But the combinations of flavor are without exception classical. I'm an absolute believer and respect the fact that before my time and before the world of the modern super chef, there were generations and generations of, we're talking about France in the most part here, French people who cooked and ate with a desire to eat delicious food and also to sustain themselves, obviously. And they will have tried, for example, with a myriad of different, but through their experiment over all these generations, actually the things that were yielded, sort of distillation process, was duck with orange, duck with cherries, duck with...
Right.
And so I think I absolutely adhere to those. Nobody out there in the big world of modern cooking has demonstrated to me that innovative combinations of flavour are... I've never had anything more than the harm classical combinations can bring. Sometimes a great cook can pull something clever off, but the truth is harmony of flavour, satisfaction that delivers, resides in the domain of classical flavours, I think. Technique, on the other hand, and how you produce... How you cook these things and present them is a different matter, and that's where there's scope for innovation and progression.
And there's room for that. I mean,
there is room for that. As a human being, I'm not very analytical about anything, or particularly inquisitive. And as a chef, I have no internal desire to try and innovate and be clever. And that's what it is. So I like to use pretty much the same repertoire of ingredients. There's new things come in, certainly in the sort of, as they become more readily available to in the markets,
whether it's
fiddlehead ferns or whether it's, you know, there are new ingredients come that have been foraged and brought in. And of course, I'd love to use those kind of things. But still, I'm a great believer that food has to nourish your soul as much as anything else. And that is best delivered in lovely, sensuous flavors and textures. And that is best delivered very much respecting classical French technique.
Your menu, which changes so frequently, is so gorgeous. I can't even imagine how you select anything. And we're going to be having lunch here. And what are you going to recommend out of all these wonderful dishes that we have to taste?
It's a little bit of a frustrating time because what's going on outside is spring.
Yes.
It's big time spring. I mean, it's
almost
summer.
Almost, right.
And the problem is, it's very frustrating this time of year because the weather changes, if we're lucky. It certainly has this year. And that triggers a psychological switch from winter to spring. So we're all in spring mindset. We're there. We've moved. We've left winter behind. But the reality is that in March, when that human mindset changes, actually the ingredients are still really pretty much winter. There are a few things because the warm weather triggers growth. There's not immediate yield from fields, so to speak. So there's still not a big variety of spring ingredients around.
We just had Jersey royals,
yes.
Which I had never, in all these years I've been coming to England, have never tasted.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are wonderful.
Jersey Royal is a wonderful thing. We have a sea trout dish, actually, which you should try. It is delicious, and it's the very first of the new season sea trout, which is not dissimilar to salmon, served with crushed Jersey Royals and little shrimps, and it's absolutely lovely. Morels are here. They're pretty liberally strewn over the menu. They are one of the first things to arrive.
Why did you select a morel for the cover?
I wanted just to have beautiful pictures of... I just wanted beautiful images, and I just think it's a beautiful image. So we change with the seasons.
Oh, they do too. Okay.
Yeah, and so I select an ingredient, a lovely image that reflects one of the current ingredients of that season.
Let's start with the options. Now, here we are. We're at lunchtime, and you have a set menu.
Yeah, we offer a set menu, which is there to offer a more affordable route into the square. The cooking is, by and large, slightly simpler, slightly more modest ingredients on the whole, but it's still in no way a compromise on the kind of food that we cook. You're still getting a great experience, but it is slightly simpler. And I'm also a great believer that actually at lunchtime, most people have not yet got to a point in the day where they want to have a full-blown, sophisticated gastronomic experience. Yeah. Our lunch trade is, in the most part, made up of local business people, local people coming in, and they just want to come and have a lovely lunch. So it's simpler things. They don't require to have to sit and look at them and work it out and savour every little bit. It's just more user-friendly on the palate and more familiar things. And so that's the lunch menu. And then we also offer the a la carte, which is the full experience, the full choice.
What are your star starters here? Really crazy.
I haven't got the menu in front of me, but you know what's new? The spring minestrone has just gone in. The woodland minestrone, which
Peter was eyeing that.
Yeah, which is lovely, based on a stock made from squirrel and rabbit. Which sounds a little bit quirky.
But I didn't know that you cooked squirrels here.
Well, not many people do, but at this time of year, a lot of squirrels are culled to prevent them eating the songbird eggs. And
on a
lot of the estates, as in the country, it is a perk of the gamekeeper to cull the squirrels and keep the profits for himself. It's a little... And the reality is yes, you see squirrels everywhere. You see them in London. You see, but actually, out in the wild, they are it's a game meat.
So but they're rodents.
Well, what's a
I hate our squirrels that we have. Yeah.
Well, I know,
they dig up all my bulbs.
Give us the recipe, and we'll cull the Pennsylvania squirrels.
No, but that's your gardening baggage. Leave that to one side. They're a lovely wild animal, very lean meat. But I mean, the reality is they don't not spectacularly delicious to eat. But we make a stock from the squirrel bones and wild rabbits. It's quite a light, not massively different. But chicken.
You see, now I love rabbits. That's great.
Yeah, and we then lots of finely diced vegetables, and morels and garlic leaves. We're waiting for the fiddlehead ferns to come into season. They're not quite with
us yet.
They're
not ready yet.
And then we serve it will be a pheasant egg actually as of next week, but at the moment it's still just a normal chicken's egg, a slow cooked egg in there, and then a couple of croutons on the side with a rabbit rillette. And it's lovely, it's clean,
it sounds
fresh.
Divine.
It is delicious.
Run us through the tartare of Cornish mackerel with native oysters, seawater jellies, and caviar.
Yeah, you know, that's a dish that and I like. It's taking a very humble ingredient, a mackerel, and it's trying to turn it into an elegant and sophisticated dish, which I think it pretty successfully does. And you end up with a lovely little piece of grilled mackerel with a little potato salad and an oyster dressing, a tartare of mackerel, which is delicious, bound with an oyster cream. You have a native oyster, which is just at this time of year, so we've got 1 month left, dressed with a vinaigrette with tiny little jellies made from the oyster juice, which is effectively the seawater.
There's a resurgence of interest in jellies, understand.
Yeah, jellies are, well, you know, when used correctly, they provide a fresh and fun and different bit of ammunition in the armory of techniques in a kitchen. They are, obviously, can play a great role in a dish, but there are all sorts of gelling agents out there which have got, then you know, you need to tread carefully. They can bring to a dish, but they can also...
Too much is too much.
Too much is too much. And then we make a fantastic velouté with a smoked mackerel too, which is this lovely frothy, creamy soup.
How about this Cornish...
Skate salad is a take on bagna cauda, which is a classical Italian
thing. Oh, really?
Which is, yeah, it's that dressing. It's the very punchy... red wine,
anchovy,
garlic.
And garlic. Yeah.
And the skate is really this. You know, it's a unique texture skate, just the nature of its form. Steamed, so it's very delicate. But you get these filaments of skate, but it's ultimately acting as a vehicle for this dressing, which also works fantastically well with the broccoli and the blandness of not many, but a few potatoes in there.
So most of these are composed plates.
They're all composed plates. Yeah, they're all they're all composed plates. And then the signature dishes on the starter menu really are the lasagna of crab with a cappuccino of shellfish and basil, which is that's an example of where a food at its very best. It's comfort food, refined to the point where it becomes elegant and sophisticated. But ultimately, that dish exemplifies so well where it is very sophisticated and light and luxurious, but it's also comforting and it nourishes the soul and it's elegant. It's one of those rare dishes that ticks all the boxes, I think.
And the crab is so spectacular.
Yeah, the crab. We have fantastic crab in this country. And then the langoustine dish has also done us very well over the years. It's just supreme ingredients, treated very carefully. It's texturally fantastic.
Truffle.
Wonderful flavors, a bit of truffle, yeah.
That sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, it's a wonderful dish.
Now, what about the main courses?
The main courses haven't budged yet as much, seasonally speaking, just because, as I explained, we're sort of trapped between the two. But we have a cod dish, a steamed cod dish, which is with some little bit of Jersey Royal in there,
right,
with a velouté of oysters. And again, you've just got this beautiful prime piece of cod, which has got that lovely flaking texture, just coated in it's not particularly rich actually, but it is creamy through blending the oysters into this sauce that gives it this frothy, creamy texture. And it's just flavours of the sea. It's just very pure with samphire and to garnish. The sea trout is there, which is lovely and seasonal. And then onto the meats, there's a fantastic duck dish.
Oh, the tart Barbary duck.
Yeah, with a tart fiend of caramelised endive, which is very much the sort of burnt orange. There's the duck with orange in a slightly contemporary way. It's just a great, great, great thing. Towards the end of the Pyrenean lamb season, which is...
Oh, that's fabulous.
Wonderful thing.
Yeah, you got us on that one, the Pyrenean. Peter has been talking about it since he saw on your menu outside.
Yeah, No, Pyrenean lamb is very special. It's just incredibly sweet, and that's a delicious meat.
What's with scorched onions? They're on several dishes.
Yeah, scorched onions is, we basically get the onions and we cut them vertically down almost as into segments, but not right the way through. And then you roast the whole thing and it opens out like a huge flower. And so the heart of the onion cooks just enough so that it's sweet and soft, but the tips blacken. So you get this nice contrast of almost burnt ends of the onion and sweeter. The root end is still nice and sweet. It's a good mix of, flavor.
The other thing for people who are confused with so many wonderful options, you probably do a lot of tasting menus.
Yeah, we do. Particularly at the tail end of the week when people have got the time to sit back and enjoy the ride, so to speak. We do, and the tasting menu is it's not as long as some, but it's still 8-9 courses. And I'm not mad personally about eating tiny little things and you wait for another 10 or 15 minutes.
40 courses.
Just can't be done with it.
4.5 hours. I mean, terrible.
I struggle with it. But we do offer a tasting menu to give somebody a real feel of 8 or 9 dishes.
Well, some other distinguishing characteristics is your dessert list is not only extensive, but really enticing, gorgeous, gorgeous flavors. Then you have also blended tea lists, and I'm interested in teas, of course, and of course your sweet dessert wines and so forth. Now, we haven't mentioned your wines. Mostly French, right?
Well, my partner is Pat Martin is the really behind the scenes on the wines, and his absolute passion actually is Burgundy. His long term passion, but actually Italian wines has become a big thing too. But they are mostly French. But I mean, we do represent wines from all over the world. They play a significant part on the list.
And you have more than one sommelier. So
we have a team. Do we have a team of sommeliers? And if anything, as the years roll by, we are trying to make the list a little bit more intelligent. That we don't have quite as many verticals of vintages of the big grand wines. We're trying to keep in tune with where the modern pocket is, which is perhaps not quite as deep as it used to be.
Oh, and except if you're a Petrus, I guess.
Yeah. And also, actually, more and more of our customers have got, over the years, have got their own... So those big wines at
home.
Well,
this is the truth, isn't it?
Why, if you've got a fantastic Mouton at home, would you want to come and spend an extra £500 buying it in a fancy restaurant? But of course we have them there, and wine is a very important part of our business.
How difficult is it to two things: get a reservation, and secondly, where are we? How do people find you?
Very easy to find. We're right in the heart of the West End. We're right in the heart of Mayfair. beautiful part of London. We're very, we're right in amongst some of the best hotels in London. So we're very accessible, equidistant between Bond Street, Green Park, Tube Station. So we're right. And reservations are long gone, other ridiculous waiting lists that we had for many years. Because,
really?
Well, I think it's a combination of tricky economy and just the competition is fierce.
So people can get it.
Yeah, you can get it. You know, if you want to come tomorrow night, if you want to book for the following night, it's going to be tricky, but you don't need to. It's not difficult to get the table.
But you now have two other places which expands opportunity to taste your food. You've one already opened, right?
I have two already opened. I have the Ledbury, which has been open now for 7 years.
Which is, of course, a protege of yours.
Yes, I mean, the Ledbury is very much Brett's domain. I never had a huge amount to do with the food. The idea was to provide him really with an opportunity and with a bit of luck, me with a bit of income. Uh-huh. I was never going to have any. You know, he worked here. He was an outstanding cook.
Brilliant chef.
Brilliant chef. And so he is completely in control of his menu down there, and in fact the whole restaurant. I'm his partner, but he runs the show down there. And also, I never want to any other enterprises I get involved with are on that basis. This is the square is where I come to work.
Okay.
And I want to continue it.
But you do have other places, different menus.
I do have other places. I have a third place called Kitchen W8, which is in Kensington, which is a slightly more modest restaurant. It is ultimately a neighbourhood restaurant, but it's of a great standard. And again, you know, of course, I speak every day to my partners in those restaurants, but I'm never there. I never cook there, and that's how I like it to be.
Well, we're really looking forward to.
We forgot the one you're going to open very shortly.
And I have another one that's due to open in the middle of May in Barnes, which is a magical neighbourhood in London, in West London, caught in a lovely loop in the Thames, so it's very quiet.
Really?
Lovely area.
I don't think we've ever been.
Well, you're missing out on the jewel in the crown of London in terms of residential areas. It's a lovely spot. Very quiet. It's a real quality neighbourhood environment with a pond and a little pub and, it's proper.
And Phil, that one's going to be called?
That's going to be called Sunny's Kitchen.
Sunny's Kitchen.
Yeah, Sunny's is the name of the restaurant that it has been for the last 26 years, and it's bringing in the link of ownership with Kitchen W8, which is the other restaurant in Kensington. So Sunny's Kitchen is going to be.
Well, this has been a delightful conversation with you. We could go on at length, but I think we need to put you in the kitchen to cook our lunch.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's where I belong, and you must go and sit down and enjoy the ride.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Enjoy
your
lunch.
Phil. And we certainly did. And now it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And we have several programs upcoming on London, just in case you're wondering. So be sure to tune in successive weeks, because there'll be something new every week. And this week's program, in addition to introducing Phil Howard and the Square, itself an exciting experience, we wanted to highlight the fact that there seems to be quite a revival going on of interest in French food and French restaurants in London, which were the traditional restaurants. The only really fine dining restaurants in London when I lived there in the 1960s. And
it's coming back.
And it appears to be coming back. So if you recall this in the Square interview, Phil Howard said very clearly, the style of the food I cook in my restaurant is based on French technique.
Yeah, but most good chefs are like that too.
Yes, they are. But the next two interviews are certainly on that theme. First of all, Joel Antunes, when we last met him, was opening the restaurant, a brasserie at the Park Plaza Westminster Bridge to help out a friend, and then went scouting for a new restaurant property to open, and did so just a few months ago, and he has a wonderful new place in Mayfair called Kitchen Joel Antunes. And here's Joel.
Before you go there, I wanted to just mention that there are a few things about this restaurant that we never really touched on, because we didn't know about it until we talked to some of the servers later and the sommelier and so forth, including this the music bits. But there's a DJ in drag. Then there's a brunch to dark or something like that, which happens on a Saturday where you drink and eat music. And then there's also some kind of relationship to a space below where you not only eat and drink, but you dance.
Well, we didn't do those things.
We probably should have,
but we didn't. But we did have a wonderful meal. And Jolene Tunis, we thank you once again for your hospitality and for a wonderful dining experience. French with a taste of Provence and a taste of some Asian and of some Spanish.
Can I tell you the most knockout dish? Not flashy, but it's a marinated baby artichoke salad with sliced avocado, shaved parmesan, and lemon dressing. It sounds simple, but the combination is dynamite.
And we had some other wonderful things too, but you'll just have to go for yourself in order to experience this. So here's Chef Jolene Tunis of Kitchen Jolene Tunis. On the menu is in a place where the rich and famous go. Not a surprise, but it seems that the richer and the more famous come to the Embassy Restaurant by Jolene Tunis, which is where we are tonight. So I asked Joel, as we were talking beforehand, I said, who's been in recently? He said, Meryl Streep. And I said, well, was she Meryl Streep or Margaret Thatcher? So then you said, I was at Barbaloo recently and...
And Meryl Streep was next table to me. And Margaret Thatcher, I'm sorry. But Meryl Streep came to the restaurant a few times already.
Now, are you sure it wasn't Meryl Streep at Barbaloo?
No, it was Margaret Thatcher. I'm sure
you're certain of that.
Hey, let's correct something. Yeah. Now, the restaurant is actually called the Kitchen Jolene Tunis.
Well, that's only you can only say that because you have the piece of paper in front of you.
No, but it's not. It's in this building, which is Embassy in Mayfair.
Got it.
Yeah, and Mayfair is a pretty nice place to be, and I guess you're happy to be back here, right?
I'm very happy because, 20 years ago, I used to have a restaurant on not far from here called Les Saveurs. And Les Saveurs in the 90s was a huge success in London. And it was one of the top five restaurants in London. And to back to Mayfair, I'm very, very happy. I have a great experience at the Park Plaza, but for me, I like restaurant more than a hotel.
Right. Yes, you were helping out friends who,
exactly, you know,
who had started the Park Plaza Westminster Bridge when we ate together just about a year ago.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, you have such a variety of experience. I mean, you are legitimately a French chef and coming from a very interesting area in the south of France. And you worked with some of the greats in this industry. And you even did a stint in... I just can't picture why you would ever go cook in Atlanta and Georgia in the United States, but you did that too. But now you're back, and this is like a dream restaurant for you, is it?
Yes, it's very nice. It's a great opportunity, and the restaurant, the location is fantastic. It's a small restaurant, 75 seats. And,
how many?
75 seats.
Okay, it's a good size.
It's a good size. It's perfect. And but you know, when I was in Atlanta, Georgia, I was very surprised at the beginning, but it was very, very good experience. And it was few very good restaurants in Atlanta, and my 12 years I spent in the U.S. in Atlanta was fantastic.
Well, you know, Atlanta has become quite a food town. They are in their second year of a major food and wine festival this year, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the whole world is changing in terms of food.
Exactly.
Now, if we're talking about change, you know, your food has evolved over these years, French by background and training, but you're also very, very contemporary and cutting edge as well.
Yes, and today what I'm trying to do, and when I open a restaurant, I try to please my customer. And in this area, we have a lot of women, for lunch and dinner. And it's why on my menu you have a lot of ceviche, amachi and tuna.
Yeah, I was looking at that ceviche.
And because you have to give what the people want to eat on the markets. I remember 20 years ago when I opened my restaurant, and if the people don't want something on the menu, I say, okay, you have to leave, go next door.
You didn't do that.
Yeah. And now, you have, because before, it was a big time for the Michelin star. It was, everyone tried to be the best. And today, at 49, I think differently. I want to please my customer. Everything I can do for them, I would be happy to do it.
So that is one big difference in terms of your current attitude and your current restaurant. Yeah. What are some of the other really personal touches you bring to the kitchen, Joël à Tunis?
You can see the design is very like a French Riviera, and I try to bring some Mediterranean influence, and because most of the time we're very for dinner we're busy but late, you know, we never get a most of the customer come to the restaurant after 9 o'clock, and
so it's very European.
Yes, like in Spain, you know, in Spain there's nobody before 10 o'clock.
11.
Yeah, 11 o'clock. And in Visaya, before 9 o'clock, the restaurant is like empty. In Atlanta, Georgia, after 9, we closed. Yeah. you have to adapt to concept of cooking and opening and everything on the market. And for me, it's very important because at the end, it's a business and you have to be successful. Yeah.
Now, how long are you open and what days of the week?
We opened 3.5 months ago. We opened the last week of November, and we opened 5 days a week. We close on Sunday and Monday.
Sunday and Monday.
Yes.
And you're open for lunch and dinner.
Lunch and dinner.
Okay. Yeah. And that outdoor dining I see behind my shoulder, do you have any outdoor seating?
Yes, we have, I think it's 28 seats.
It's lovely out there.
It's very nice. For lunch, it's always busy. Dinner is still too cold, but I'm sure in 1.5 months we'll be okay.
You'll be okay.
Yeah, but lunch is always very, very busy because people like it, you know.
Now, you have a cocktail and wine program.
Yes.
And do people eat at the bar as well?
Yes, yeah.
And it's very French. It's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a very good sommelier. His name is Yuri. He's from Italy, and it's very, very nice. I have a good team on the wine program, and on the cocktail, I have a very nice bartender.
You know, we know a sommelier in Pittsburgh named Yuri, but okay. He's Russian.
Okay.
Now, tell us a little bit. Your wines, are they mainly French?
Yes.
All French?
No, we have Spanish and Italian because, you know, the idea of this restaurant is to be like Mediterranean. Donc, you can see on the menu the food is like a little bit Italian, Provençal, and a little bit Spanish. We have two dishes more Asian influence for the ceviche and crudo, but most is Mediterranean. Donc, the wine list is like 50% French, 25% Italian, 25% from Spain.
We're going to be having dinner here, and tell us and our listeners, what dishes are you going to recommend that we try and why?
I love the amachi. And amachi yellowtail.
Yeah.
It's very good. I make a dressing with citrus, yuzu, lime, lemon. And it's very fresh. And also because I spent 3 years in Asia, I love Japanese food. So you can feel the Japanese influence. Mm-hmm. I have a beautiful Niçoise salad.
You should.
Yeah. Beautiful tuna tartare. And the chicken liver parfait also is very, very good. And next month, I'm going to start my new menu with gazpacho with tomato sorbet, asparagus, zucchini flour, you know, all the Provençal
dish.
Really? Yeah.
Well, that sounds good, too. Yeah. But that's not until next month, huh?
Yeah. And on the main course, beautiful scallops, live scallop from Scotland. Sea bream is fantastic with light ginger balls.
Yeah, I looked at that one. That sounded really good.
It's very nice. It's fresh, light, and it's very, very nice dish. And the shrimps, I have a blue shrimps, served with vermicelli and curry. It's very nice also.
This is not light, but my eye went immediately to this oxtail tortellini with Swiss chard and parmesan.
Yeah, it's good.
That's good.
It's good, yeah. But it's different. It's very rich, you know.
Yeah. No. You have a thing for desserts. Why is that? You like desserts.
I love it. And
you have a huge list of desserts and cheeses here.
Yes, we have 8 desserts. Sometimes we have 10. Next month we're going to have 10 because next month we have the strawberry season star. We're going to have the Mara de Bois and Garriguette from south of France and Spain. And apricot also in April and peach. Donc, I like to use all the fruit.
Uh-huh.
And
But you're forgetting where you are. You're in the capital of Desertia. You're in the country where cousin Michael's wife Winifred went to dessert camp.
Yeah, that's true.
We've speculated for a long time about whether or not it might make sense to have an all dessert.
Mm-hmm.
There was one in New York, almost all dessert.
Yes, yeah. She used to work for me. It's a woman, Japanese woman, called Chikasimo.
Okay. I was just about to say the name. Good thing I did. Yeah. What's your favorite dessert on the current menu? You have exotic fruit pavlova.
Fantastic, and the Kit Kat.
And the what?
Kit Kat.
Oh, yes. The Kit Kat caramel tonka bean ice cream. That sounds good, too.
Yes, it's, the taste is like America, because I use the peanut butter. I use a crispy rice with a little bit marshmallow, melted marshmallow. And you have the crunchy, you have the chocolate mousse with peanut butter, salty caramel, and tonka bean ice cream.
Now, only English people or English candy eaters around the world will know that a Kit Kat is a candy bar.
Of course it is.
And because you knew that?
Of course.
You knew that, okay.
But it's
then why didn't you mention it if you knew that? Since you're so smart.
It's an American candy bar, isn't it?
No, it's a British candy bar.
Is it British?
Absolutely.
I think so, yeah.
Absolutely.
I thought it was American.
No, it's only because it's imported into the United States.
I see. Anyhow,
this is English as rice pudding.
What else would you think that our listeners would be interested in knowing about coming here?
About the embassy. Embassy, you know, it was a men's club opened, I think, in 1876. And it was always very, very successful. And they closed in 2010 for renovation. And when some people approached me to open this place, and I was very excited because the location is very nice. And to back in restaurant, you know, when you have a background of restaurant, it's different than hotel. It's two different world. And for me, I like restaurant business better than hotel business. It's a very good opportunity. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I can say congratulations. Yeah. Bon chance, but I'm sure you don't need any kind of luck because you have all the background. We love your cooking.
Thank you.
And I think this is a wonderful opportunity for you and for us to have a good dinner.
Thank you, madame.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Joe.
You're very welcome.
And just remembered another dish he wants to recommend to you.
Well, I was just going to suggest that he actually, although it's French, he does extend into the regions, the realm of Basque, for example, with his milk-fed lamb shoulder with chickpeas and spices. And then also, he gets a little of the Asian in here with this roast sea bream with a light ginger broth that was absolutely scrumptious.
Now, if you want the Pyrenean or the Basque lamb, you better get there quickly because it's going out of season in the next couple of weeks. So anyway, let's take a short break before we go for our last interview in this program.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
In our final segment, we have what I think many people would think of as an oxymoron, certainly a surprise. A British chef who's made a career cooking fine French food and who 10 years ago opened his very own restaurant called Racine, named not after Racine, Wisconsin, or not after Racine, any other place for that matter, but a playwright, I believe, of the classical French era. And Henry Harris talks about that, talks about why he thinks French cooking is so important, and talks about how he's executing it at Racine and executing it, I might say, to, what's the word, dear? Perfection?
Oh, I keep thinking of that came at the end of the meal, the tête de veau.
I keep on thinking about everything that we had and wondering if what I'm cooking for dinner is going to come anywhere close.
Oh, please.
Henry, I'm sure you're listening.
Does he talk about soft roast? I don't think he does.
And the interesting thing is, I was talking to my fishmonger the other day, and he said, "Oh yes,
he knows it.
He knows about it." He said, "You don't see it very often, but in fact, it's the roe equivalent of a male herring." Now, let's not go into it any further than that, other than to tell you it's one of the most delicious things that will ever cross your lips. So, if it's on the menu, get it.
Well, we can approach Racine, the name of this restaurant, from two different angles, according to proprietor and chef Henry Harris. Henry, I loved your story about this because we immediately read your bio and decided, you said after cooking all these different style cuisines, you're going to open this French restaurant and get back to your roots. And I'm thinking that's why it's called Racine. But that's not really why it's called Racine at all. Tell us.
Not really. I mean, it came about by default. I was I had a partner when we opened the restaurant, and we were looking at lots of different names. And I wanted something that was related to the Comédie Française and, you know, Molière and Beaumarchais. And my partner wanted lots of other names that were wholly inappropriate. So we did lists. And we got to the point where, in fact, the man who did the beautiful glass and gold sign over the front of the restaurant said, if you don't tell me the name of the restaurant tomorrow, I can't sketch it and get the planning process going. So we wrote lots of names down, and I put Racine down, not as going back to my culinary roots, but as the poet and playwright, and looked through the list the next morning with my ex-partner, and we kind of went rubbish, rubbish, rubbish at each list. And then he suddenly went, Racine, we're going back to our roots. And I went, perfect. You can say it. A cab driver can say it. I can say it. And so that's how it came to be.
I think that's
But it is really, it, you're right, though. It is. It's about a return to my roots. Not so much the root, not my absolute culinary roots. So my mother has always been a fantastic cook. And in the
have you noticed people's mothers are either terrible cooks or fantastic cooks?
Yeah, mine fell into a different category. And the only reason I can say that is she can't really hear me anymore because she's not paying much attention.
Okay, so you're telling us that she was a fantastic cook.
And all through the 60s and 70s, she was, you know, one of those wonderful home cooks who, whenever she entertained, would always do three puddings. And worked from the complete works of Elizabeth David, Jane Grigson, Robert Carrier, Constance Spry. And that, with holidays to France and Italy, put good food and appreciation of someone putting a lot of effort into good ingredients together for me. But it was always French cooking that I always kind of felt most comfortable with. And in fact, when I worked for Simon Hopkinson, who I worked for 8 years, those first 2 or 3 years, so much of it was of that same bent of Elizabeth David, Richard Olney, Jane Grigson. And so I stuck with it. And I also think from a cook's perspective, in London now we're spoilt. We can get the most beautiful fruit and vegetables from France, Spain, Italy. There are specialist importers who really do go and look for little farmers growing proper leaf spinach and bringing it over. And it makes it very easy to do what I do and make it enjoyable. But I still think that French cooking travels better than most other countries. Why? I don't know.
Now, how old is this restaurant? I mentioned that you tend to stay someplace when you get there, like a mollusk on a rock.
Exactly. I do sometimes move a little faster than that. Not often, though. I've got my 10th birthday coming up in June of this year.
For this restaurant, I see.
For this restaurant.
And it's obviously it's a success. What is so special about it? Because there are lots of French restaurants in London.
I think I don't really know the answer to that. I have an idea. It's, I believe passionately that good food should be the serving of good ingredients, based at their best, and served to all our customers and friends with warmth and affection and nice old-fashioned style by my waiting team. And I think it's just all of those things coming together that make it a restaurant that people want to come to.
Do you have a specific demographic? Because of the area you're in, it's going to be well-heeled, and it's not going to be 17 to 25-year-olds.
You're right. We do get our 17 to 25-year-olds. Yeah. The main core is locals who live within, you know, a mile of here. I mean, it is so beautifully residential around here.
Absolutely lovely. And good shopping, too.
Exactly.
Except for the exchange rate.
Yeah, that doesn't quite help. That doesn't quite help.
No.
We get a beautiful, well-heeled local clientele. We get local businessmen. We get food tourists. I always hate that phrase, but people,
oh no,
when we go traveling now and we go looking for restaurants, we're food tourists.
Oh, yeah.
I do it all the time. Well, not enough.
Culinary tourists.
Culinary
tourists,
gastro tourists, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
And then we get other restaurateurs, but we do, you know, lunchtime today, I looked out, there was a lovely young man in his late 20s who'd just come for lunch on his own.
Now,
he knew about the restaurant and he thought, oh, I just fancy, you know, a prefix lunch, bit of anglais, and that's what he had.
Now, how often do people come in your neighbourhood? Do they come on the same day each week, or do they come twice a month?
It really varies. So many people who live around here, this isn't their only home, so you can't
tell when they're going to be here or when they're not going to be here. They all act, and quite rightly so, as if they own Racine and come and go as they choose and see fit.
Did they make special requests or accept your menu pretty much as it is?
It's evolved into, I think, what they want. We get the odd person that does. We have one lovely couple who come a couple of times a month, and he'll phone the day before if he's coming a Friday, and he'll say, you know, what I really fancy is some good fish and chips, and I'll get some
lovely...
Cod. So I'll do him deep-fried cod, some lovely chips, tartar sauce, and then I have to make sure I've got plenty, because they always arrive early, and the moment the first one goes out through the dining room, you know, everyone else is going to go, oh, I didn't see that on the menu, can I have that? Well, of course you can. No. I always, many years ago, I worked on a on the man who inspired me to cook, who's this lovely gentleman who sadly died a few years ago, Carl Loderer, who had a restaurant in West Sussex called Manlitz. And before that, he was the founding chef of Gravetye Manor, where he cooked for 13 years. And at the bottom of his menu, he had this lovely little sentence saying, Chef Loderer proposes this menu for your enjoyment this evening, but should there be something that you really would like that you can't see on the menu, please ask, and providing we have the ingredients, he will be only too happy to do it for you. And blow me, he did. Saturday night, it would always be at about 8:45, when the whole world had descended upon us, and someone would go, I'd like a zabaglione, please. And he'd go, Chef. And he'd stop, and he'd do it.
It's gotten out of hand now, though, I think, with people allergic to garlic and allergic to this. And
we did... We did have someone who came in the other day who had three sheets of A4 of what they could and couldn't eat. At least they knew. It was quite precise, and I went through. And I always think, err on the side of caution.
They should stay home.
Sadly, the people who really do have the most serious allergies don't get to eat out because they can't take
the risk.
There's
a book out called Passport with Allergies, and it tells you where to go, what kind of restaurants.
Oh, yeah, in any kind of cuisine.
Any kind of cuisine. So if you have such and such, you can order this and that. It's easy. What are the stars of this current menu I'm looking at? There look to be many from my perspective, but from your experience
from my
here.
Perspective,
yeah.
Well, it's a combination of old friends and new friends. The old friends, as it's been on since the beginning, the garlic and saffron mousse with the mussel butter sauce, which is, I've always said, it's kind of probably the only original dish I've come up with. It's a beautiful, set, warm custard made with garlic, saffron, it's a bit of cream and egg.
Oh, I see it right here. Mm. And you have mussels in that, too.
And it's got mussels, and it's just a mussel butter sauce with some chives and parsley. On the fish side, soft roe, it's herring roe, soft herring roe season. So those are always lovely. And it's amazing how popular they are, actually.
Really? Skate?
Skate. Oh, I do like my skates.
That's
a new dish coming on with the cider vinegar.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite things.
Very simple. Talking about what customers ask for and what they don't want. When I first opened Racine, I took the view that this is a local restaurant, that people want to spend less here than they do when they go up to the West End. And within 2 weeks of opening, customers were coming and saying, you know, we really love this menu, it's good, but it'd be so nice if there was a Dover sole or a fillet steak. You've got, you know, you're slightly too modest with some of the cuts. And I put fillet steaks on, and the steak au poivre, which is exactly the way Simon Hopkinson showed me how to cook it back in 1980, whatever. It's how I do it to this day, and it's rarely bettered.
I noticed here, I just had an email from a chef saying that monkfish, the price of monkfish is going up so fast that pretty soon we're going to say that we're selling lobster as the poor man's monkfish.
I wonder where he's buying it from. I mean, I have three fishmongers, one who's based through Billingsgate, one who's based on the East Coast near Colchester, and then one who sends fish up from Poole in Dorset, and play them off against each other. And monkfish, good fish isn't cheap.
No,
whichever
it is
one
not.
It is. And in fact, that monkfish is just about right. Sometimes I look at it and think, oh, I might have to put the price up. I'm watching it. Next week it could go up. But it's, you know, it's a good fish, and it needn't be silly expensive.
I'd never understand the fish market and what they do with it. We're going to be having dinner here tonight with you. And what are you going to recommend that we try?
Well, as I don't know what you had for lunch today, it makes it very difficult to say. I always think that it's, when you go to a restaurant, you should sit down and look at it, and your heart tells you what it is you want to eat. Sometimes your tummy does too.
Yeah, the heart is going to tell me I want every single one of them.
Well, we can work towards that.
Possible.
We can work towards
no,
that.
No, not
possible. I'm really not going to answer that question because that menu is designed to satisfy you, whatever mood you're in. If you're feeling fragile, and then I always think something and delicate, that something very subtle and simple like the tête de veau, providing you like fully soft, slippery cuts, is one of those wonderful things that comforts. Mm-hmm. It's not invalid food, but it is very close to becoming so. I always think if I'm feeling particularly under the weather, that a steak, you know, a big piece of beef is always going to put
really?
Me back on the map. Absolutely. A steak au poivre can
Isn't
be sensational.
That interesting?
The roast quail dish I rather like. It's just a nice big fat French quail with some morto, the smoked pork sausage, some tarbe beans.
Yeah, and you have rabbit. That's always a winner.
That's been on for 10 years.
Yeah.
I put that on to start with, and it was just like, oh, someone's doing Lapin la moutarde properly, so it's stayed there.
Question, you mentioned that your brother is also a chef.
That's right, Matthew.
Is that that's an odd coincidence or not?
Well, I think we both did it slightly. Well, our father had a restaurant in Brighton for 17 years, and I went into it. I didn't want to cook to start with. I thought I wanted to work in hotels and run a hotel. I thought that looked fantastic because you had restaurants, bedrooms, and a swimming pool to look after. That all looked very glamorous. And then I worked in a hotel and decided that wasn't quite for me. Worked in a restaurant as a waiter, and this was when I was working for Karl Lederer. And it was just watching the kind of the magic in the kitchen, the alchemy, the artistry, uh-huh. the passion, the pride. And at the age of 20, having only ever, you know, my only cooking was toast and frying an egg, I thought I need to learn how to cook. And so I did, and just loved it, and thought this was for me. And I think, and by which time, what I thought was easy, I discovered wasn't, and it was too late to do anything else. And Matthew actually probably wanted to cook and had more interest in cooking than I did beforehand. So,
And are your styles similar?
Yes and no. Because we both worked for Simon for quite a few years, there's grounding. You know, you work for an inspirational man like Simon, it's going to stick.
We should explain, this is Simon Hopkinson.
That's right.
The founding chef of Bibendum.
Yes, an author of those.
Just for those people who are not quite so familiar with the legacy of great British chefs.
And there are an awful lot of chefs who went through Simon's Kitchen. He's only cooking there for 7-8 years before he retired and focused more on writing some of the best cookery books that have been written in the last 25 years. But Matthew explores other areas of the Mediterranean a bit, but that's because I've set myself the constraints that I'm not going outside of France. There are some quite strong Spanish influences, but I just say they're
Basque.
Well,
you know, the Basque. Yeah, I was going to say, because I saw some Basque on here.
And occasionally a little bit from kind of Provence, because it's so close to the Italian border, it becomes, you know, the Riviera rather than France or Italy.
And you're not at all influenced by your wife, who is American.
No.
Vice versa, right?
Exactly. But where she influences and inspires me is having someone to tell me when I'm doing it right and when I'm doing it wrong is very good. And she used to work front of house, not here. She has helped out sometimes, but she was a formidable maitre d'.
Great.
Before children. I've got three children.
We have three.
My eldest is working here as a runner at the moment.
Okay. So I see a succession taking place here.
Yes, Georgia, I could see possibly going into restaurants. She's going off to university to do Spanish and business studies later in the year.
Are there any rules of the game in terms of making reservations here?
Picking up the phone and asking for a table is always my favourite tip to people. With restaurants now, in London now, people don't book as far in advance as they used to. And we operate a very democratic system. You phone up, and if there's a slot, you get it. If we're full...
Now, then you have restaurants selling tickets.
There are some restaurants in kind of Mayfair in the West End that are absurdly busy. And I wouldn't complain if I was that busy. But it's when they suddenly become a destination for their scene rather than their food. It's a different business.
Well, do we need to say the website?
Right. So it's Racine-or-dash, depending on your preference, restaurant.com.
That's right.
The location couldn't be more convenient. If you love to shop, whether it's window shop or buy, Brompton Road is one of the places you should go. The location is between Harrods on one side of the street and the Victoria and Albert Museum on the other side of the street. All we can say is it's 10 years old for a reason, and I'm sure it'll be here for another 10.
I hope so. I plan on this.
But be sure to get in here before the next 10 years is up. And thank you so much, Henry, for joining us today on the menu.
Thanks, Henry.
So there you have it, the first installment of On the Menu in London 2012. Be sure to join us again, same time, same place next week, for even more dining adventures. And what do we usually say at the end of the program?
Bye-bye.